Hey, let's open our Bibles to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. Right in the beginning of 2 Samuel. I don't know about you, but I get really depressed when I watch the news. Do you? So I don't watch it. I found out it's bad news whether I know about it or not. And I also find it's also mistaken often after I, you know, especially international stuff. You hear this week, then next week it's changed. So I figure if I check in every couple of months and see, you know, what bad things have recently happened, I can keep up okay. Reading newspapers kind of the same way. Read them whenever I have some time to kill and some Prozac on hand. And then I can kind of make it through. But you know, it's an odd thing. You look at the world, the news kind of exemplifies to us so many of the things that make us worried. We worry about our kids growing up in this world and our grandkids growing up in this world. And we think to ourselves, Lord, where's it all going? That's why it's good to study the Word of God. There's a tendency, I think, in every generation to think that their generation has probably seen the worst. And I've noticed about people my own age, that is in the middle. If you live to be 100, I'm in the middle. So we'll call it middle. Every generation tends to worry about what's going on and tends to think that this is as bad as it's going to be. And that's why when we study God's Word, it's so refreshing to find out it's always been this bad. I mean, I don't mean that. I don't mean that, you know, to depress us even further. The fact of the matter is, it has not gotten appreciably worse. It has always been this bad. It has always been a very difficult thing to live in a fallen world. When we live in this world and we look around at the dangers of it, we look around at the moral decline. I was talking with a man just yesterday who is Christian, but he's from another part of the country, and we just happened to run into each other. We were in the same place at the same time and struck up a conversation. He is 80 years old, and he said, I'm really worried about where the world is going. And I said, well, where are you going? Actually, is what I wanted to ask him, and I found out he's a genuine believer. But as he looked at the situation, and we began to discuss the Lord and what the Lord was doing, I found out that in his generation, which is the one right ahead of mine, he's the age of my parents, that generation felt the same way at my age about the world that I do about the world, and they're looking at it the same way. So we talked about the Word. We talked about what God had been doing. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to say, the Lord has known about this all along. It gets better and worse and then better and worse and then better and worse. But the fact of the matter is, it is a sinful, fallen, dangerous world with moments of enjoyment in it and some periods of relative peace in it. But the bottom line is, it's a dangerous place. How then can God use this? In fact, it's one of the big philosophical questions. How can God, who's supposed to be good and omniscient, use or tolerate such a place? Because we ourselves wouldn't. And I find that that philosophical question comes from thinking about things only from a human standpoint. Because he affirms consistently that he is not only willing, but able, and consistently does use the fallenness of this world to bring about his will. You say, well, how can that be? What does he do? The paradigm for understanding it is the cross. The murder of God's Son, God in the flesh, by other creatures created in God's image. This is the nadir of all human sin. This is archetypical evil. And God turned it inside out and created life out of it. If he can do that, then our unanswered questions concerning his ability to work in a fallen world need to be put into their proper perspective. We need to take him at his word. We need to trust that he knows what he's doing. So how does all that fit into 2 Samuel? It fits in beautifully. Matter of fact, you could use this to introduce almost any section of narrative scripture that you come across. Because almost everywhere you dip into human history, you will find chaos, confusion, and sin. But if you're looking for what God is doing, you will also find him working behind the scenes, even using the sins of human beings to bring about his will, just like he did at the cross. And we move into 2 Samuel, do the first four chapters tonight. We're moving into a situation in which if you'd have looked at Israel as a godly person in Israel at the time, you'd be throwing your hands up. You'd be saying, how can anything good come out of this? Here's what was happening at about this time, and this is about 1010 B.C. About 1010 B.C. is roughly the period that's taking place in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and through 4. David, who's supposed to be the king, is actually hiding out with the Philistines. I mentioned this last time. He's been a Philistine mercenary. Not really, but the Philistines thought he was. For the past 16 months, and before that, for several years, running for his life from Saul of Tarsus. I mean, from, not Saul of Tarsus, heavens. Strike that from the record. From King Saul. King Saul has now been killed, along with Jonathan, his son, who people would have loved to be king. But Jonathan also died. Most of Saul's family died. One man was left, whose name was Ishbael or Ishbosheth. We'll meet him a little bit later. Had you been an Israeli at the time, you would have said, the world is caving in. The Philistines have just defeated the armies of Israel. David is down with the Philistines. And not involved in that battle, of course, but he's sort of on the Philistine side. Israel now, without a leader and without any military, real military strength to speak of, is at the mercy of the Philistines, who will plunder them indefinitely, it appears. Where is God in all of this? And yet, when you look at the first four chapters of 2 Samuel, the thing that comes screaming through is that God is very much on the throne. That what he was doing in Saul's life was exactly what he said he was going to do in Saul's life. That the populace did not know about, but that God knew about and we know about because of this word and because Samuel recorded it and so on. What he had said he would do in David's life was on the verge of taking place, although you couldn't have convinced David at the time. He wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. He was down there in Ziklag while Saul was being defeated up at Gilboa. Right at this moment, it's the beginning of a wonderful work of God. But had you looked at it at the time, had you been an Israeli at the time, you'd have thought, the Lord has deserted us. What's gone wrong? But God does use these times. And he uses it in David's life, and he uses it in Israel's life. There's a purpose behind it all. And I find the greatest challenge as a believer is to trust that that's true. When we can't see and feel and taste the truth of it right this minute. This is where the tests are, right here. This is where it is. As we look into 2 Samuel, beginning in chapter 1, David hears of Saul's death, and he's actually terribly grieved. He writes a beautiful lament in the second half of 2 Samuel 1, and it's a marvelous thing. But before we get to that, we'll see how the thing unfolds. David has just now rescued the city of Ziklag from the Amalekites. His own city has been taken and kidnapped, and David has gone and rescued them. The swords are still bloody from this battle as he brings his people back. And just a couple of days later, a man stumbles up to David and says, I am responsible for the death of Saul the king. We'll see how David deals with it. It came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and that was when he rescued Ziklag and chased, you remember it from the last time, chased the Amalekites and rescued his own family and everybody else and brought him back. When he returned from that and remained 2 days, it was all, 2 days at Ziklag. It happened on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about that when he came to David, he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said, where do you come from? He said, I escaped from the camp of Israel. David said, well, how did things go? He knew there was a war going on up there. He had actually supposed to have been a part of it. Remember, because he was kind of in a jam. He was like on the Philistine side. And then he got out of being in that battle, so he didn't have to fight against the Israelis. And it's an interesting story. But he's very interested in how it went. How did things go? Tell me. He said, the people have fled from the battle. And many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead. This would have hit David like a bucket of bricks. This, because Jonathan was such his friend. And to see that Saul would fall, as we're going to see, David, even though Saul was a terrible man, David saw the dynasty of Israel, the leadership of Israel, as being very important. And the loss of Saul represented a terrible loss to Israel. Even though it needed to happen, and even though it was turned, it would be an advantage to David, he doesn't see it that way. He doesn't, like, rejoice about this thing. So this would have hit him very hard, but especially the loss of Jonathan, his good friend, who he had hoped, and Jonathan had hoped, that when he became king, Jonathan would be by his side as his commander. To hear that both of them are dead and that Israel's lost this terrible war. The young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa." Because David asked him, "How do you know this is true?" Of course, he says, "Well, I was on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were pursuing him closely. And he looked behind him, and he saw me, and he called to me, and he said, 'Here I am.' I said, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Who are you?' I answered, 'I'm an Amalekite.' He said, 'Well, then stand beside me and kill me, because agony has seized me, because my life still lingers in me.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I brought them here to my lord, to David," see? Now, question, is he lying? See, it does not fit exactly with what we read in chapter 31. And as you might expect, among scholars who study these things, they're split as to whether or not they think he lied or whether he's telling the truth. You can reconcile the stories. It's possible. We know that Saul committed suicide, but it might not have worked entirely. And it's possible that he did, that he was in the process and had tried to commit suicide but wasn't dead yet, and that this guy came upon him and finished the job. It's theoretically possible. Or it's possible this guy's lying, that he came on Saul after he was dead, picked up his crown and his bracelet, and said, "I'm going to make some points here, because I have heard that David," if even an Amalekite, hello, "had heard that David ought to be the king." He comes down to Ziklag, hoping maybe to get a place in the new cabinet when David takes over. However, in either case, is this a trustworthy man? And this is a question we need to ask. In either case, is this a trustworthy man? Answer, no. If he's lying to David about doing this, he's not trustworthy. If he's telling the truth to David about doing this, he's also not trustworthy, because to kill the king of Israel is murder and assassination, even if the king asks you to do it. So, Dr. Kevorkian, listen up, huh? So David executes this man immediately. And at first we look at this and we say, well, why would he do that? But when you think back through what this guy is saying, even though David doesn't know the actual facts yet, all he has is this guy's word for it, it is a pretty wise decision on David's part to do this. And he apparently takes this man at face value, because he executes him for raising his hand against the king of Israel. So you can pay your money and take your choice whether you think that this guy's telling the truth or lying. He may very well have been lying. Either way, he's not the kind of guy David wants to reward. To reward this man in either case would set a terrible precedent. David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so did the men who were with him. They mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him these things, "Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm an Amalekite." Now that's a very unfortunate name to have on his passport on this particular day, if you'll remember where David just came from. Because he has just destroyed an Amalekite army that came and took his entire family away. So I don't think David was particularly inclined to believe anybody who was an Amalekite at this particular time. David said, well, how is it that you were not afraid to stretch out your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed? David himself wouldn't have done this, see? And neither would Saul's own armor bearer, according to the last chapter of 1 Samuel. So how is it that you take it upon yourself, even if he asked you to, how is it that you believe it's your job to kill somebody, considering you're taking their life? And it's not a war where you're fighting for your life, and this guy's coming after you with a sword, you just took his life. What's the problem here? How is it you think you're... About this time, this Amalekite guy's wondering if maybe this was not such a wise thing to do. David called one of his young men and said, kill him. And they did, immediately. Not a long process on death row. Death row is very, very short in David's prison system. And David said, your blood is on your own head. Your mouth has testified against you, saying, I've killed the Lord's anointed. And it's a little ambiguous whether David really believed him or whether David is simply... All he says is, if what you say is true, you deserve to be executed. But the wisdom of it is, even if what he said was a lie, David couldn't afford to have him around without proving that it was a lie, which he couldn't. So then David writes a lament, which is a particular type of psalm. David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan. Remember, David was a musician, and he would put his theology into music and his feelings. All the psalms, especially the laments, are just like liquid feeling. When you read them, you have to read them not looking for doctrinal positions, but looking for the feelings that are in them. And David is grieved, and he taught it to the people. He told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. They learned by putting things to music in order to memorize. They were an oral culture, and they had huge, huge amounts of information memorized. And the way a lot of times they did it was through little tricks of memorization, where they would use the first letter of the alphabet and so on, work, or they'd put it to music and they would sing it. And he made all of his guys learn this song. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? There's some famous lines in here, by the way, that are used in other contexts, but they come out of this lament. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, and the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. In other words, they died fighting. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You've been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? David and Jonathan's relationship of friendship and camaraderie had so bonded them that David even compares it to the strength of his love for his wives. And he says, Jonathan, our friendship was so strong. And he's completely grieved by this. By the way, friendships among men can be among the most powerful. Men will allow themselves to have those kind of friendships. And very often they're forged in the face of terrible danger and in the face of terrible oppression. But they become bonded together. That's the way David and Jonathan were. They had fought side by side and almost died on many, many occasions. Now to find out that Jonathan has been killed in battle, it just grieves David. So he writes this and he has everyone memorize it because he wants them to remember the real history. He wants them to remember Saul and Jonathan as heroes. He does not want to simply rewrite the book and say, well, I'm the hero and Saul was the goat. He says, no, I want you to understand this was the king of Israel. This was a terrible loss to Israel. And though we may rebuild and we will rebuild, I want a memorial and I don't want to just build it. I want you to put it in your mind. I want you to never forget it. So they memorized the song. All the soldiers singing. memorizing their theology and their history in song. It's a great thing. Chapter 2. Now it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord. He didn't know what was going to happen, and we'll come back to this. David had no idea. Now he knew Saul was dead, but what is he going to do? He's in Ziklag, which is in Philistine territory. And a lot of people in Israel think he's a deserter. What is he going to do? But notice that he doesn't have to know all the political ins and outs. All he has to do is know the Lord. And all he has to do is what God calls him to do. So he comes to the Lord because he has a priest with him, Abiathar, and he's able to inquire directly of the Lord. And now, since he will eventually become the king, it's his right and his responsibility to do that. He asks the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said, "Yes, do that." And David said, "Where?" And he said, "Hebron." The Lord conveyed to him, whether through the Urim and the Thummim or through a prophetic word, probably the Urim and the Thummim, through Abiathar, the high priest. And this is a perfect place for David to go because Hebron is in the south. In fact, find a map. I'll show you. I'll show you where Hebron is. You need to see this. You also need to see a couple other places as we kind of move through this. Find that map in the back of your Bible or somewhere with a friend if they've got maps in their Bible that shows the patriarchal period or Israel divided among the 12 tribes, something like that, or the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, the kingdom period. And notice that Ziklag, always find the Dead Sea first and the Sea of Galilee. Then you orient yourself. Find about the middle of the Dead Sea, go due west and a little bit south, and you'll see Ziklag there. That's where he's been. Now, if you move back up to the north and a little bit to the east, you find Hebron. This is in the southern portion of the province of Judah. Now, David has been, during this last 16 months, faking it as a mercenary among the Philistines, but raiding against enemies of Israel, and he would bring the stuff that he would get from his raids, and he'd pass it around among the leaders of the guys of the cities around Hebron. Hebron was the most important city in southern Judah at the time. In fact, in probably the most important city in Judah at the time. This is where Abraham was buried, okay? So it's a very important place. And so for David to go to Hebron is extremely important. This becomes his capital, is what happens. His first capital before he takes Jerusalem. And we'll see that later. Now, a couple other places that you ought to know about. One is Mahanaim, which is up across from the Jordan River. Go up halfway between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, or a little above halfway, and go to the east. You'll see right up in there someplace, Jabesh-Gilead, and Mahanaim. Now, that'll vary because they're not exactly sure where Mahanaim was. It means two camps, and our camp is actually named after our kids' camp, Camp Mahanaim. We sort of mispronounce it, but it's okay. It means two camps. And it became the headquarters for the northern part, not Judah, but the northern part of Israel. Now, notice, come back down across the Jordan River, come south a little bit along the mountaintops there until you find Gibeah. And you will find that in Gibeah, there will be a major, major set too. And we'll see that in just a minute. So these are the places that you're going to need to know about. Hebron becomes David's capital. In the north, we'll meet Ishbosheth or Ishbaal in a minute. But his capital will be at Mahanaim. Okay? All right, let's go back and we'll have a look at things. So he goes to Hebron. David goes to Hebron. And it's the perfect place for him to be. He brought his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. They were too many. It's about 1,000 people, and so they basically doubled the population, no doubt, of Hebron and the villages surrounding it. And this made it, and plus these are all soldiers. So this is a small army. Hebron suddenly became the best defended city in that part of the world, all of a sudden. And David now becomes pretty much the leader. The men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. But this is just the southern portion. He's not king of all Israel yet. And they told David, they said, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. They remember that story? How Jabesh-Gilead, they came across the Jordan River, and they took Saul's mangled remains, took him down off the gates of Beth-Shean, and brought his remains back and gave him a decent burial. these guys at Hebron tell David about this. Now, what David does at this point is very kingly. He starts acting like a king immediately because he sends a delegation and he sends a message to the men of Jabesh-Gilead way far up in the north. It's in the very heart of the northern portion of the kingdom. And that northern portion was very pro-Saul. And so he sends a message up there, and it's very good diplomacy. As the new king of Judah, he's biding his time, but he sends this message. David sent messengers, verse 5, to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed of the Lord, because you've shown this kindness to Saul, your Lord, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show his loving kindness and truth to you. And I also will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant. For Saul, your Lord, is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." What's David saying? He's saying, you've done a good thing. I'm proud of you. You are good people. I'm the king of Judah. Would you like to join up? You see the implication? Very strong diplomatic message. Plus, most of the people in Israel knew that David was to be the next king. So this is a direct invitation to the people who loved Saul the most, that David appreciated them for giving Saul a good burial. He's not bad-mouthing Saul. This is great, great diplomacy on David's part. They don't listen at first, but it's still good diplomacy. But Abner, verse 8, Abner was the general under Saul. Now, how he escaped the battle, we don't know. Generals and kings usually had a good way to get out if things were going bad. But Abner had escaped, so Abner, being Saul's general, becomes the power in the north. And when David sends these guys, now it is becoming obvious politically what's going on. Again, I want you to be reminded that God works what he does even in the midst of bizarre politics, and you're going to see quite a bit of it in these chapters. Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, whose other name is Ishbaal, which means son of Baal. Hello. And Ishbosheth means son of shame. So this is not a man who has a good reputation, but he's the last son of Saul left. And so Abner needs a son of Saul. He can't just walk in and say, "I want to be the king of the north." He can't do that. He has to take a relative of Saul. So he finds Ishbosheth. And he says, "This is your new king." But it says Abner did it. You see, because he's the general. He's the power up there. Even though they've lost the war, and even though the people are scattered, they respect Abner in the north. And so Abner really does this. He sets up Ishbosheth as the king in the north at Mahanaim. Verse 9. "And he made him king over Gilead, the Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, and over all Israel," which isn't saying much because Israel had been decimated by this war. These are people living in caves and staying away from their towns and doing a lot of camping at the time, okay? And they don't have much of a standing army, but they're kind of getting it together a little bit, and they've moved their capital across the Jordan River where it's safe from the Philistines over in Mahanaim. So He sets up a kingdom there with Ishbosheth. Verse 10, "Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel. He was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David." So now you have two kingdoms, essentially, north and south. David is 30 at this time. We know that from another passage. Ishbosheth is 40. No doubt, David remembers Ishbosheth from his court days when they were kids together. These guys all know each other. And he's known Abner all these years. These guys all know each other. So, verse 11, "The time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. That means it was going to be another 7.5 years. After all these years of running, another 7.5 years, and he still doesn't have the complete kingdom. Remember the patience of David, as you see the impatience of some of these other guys. So Abner tried, he does something of a power grab. And what happens is then Abner comes down, then David's main general, whose name is Joab, he's one of David's nephews, David's sister's sons. They meet in verses 12 and following. In those last 2 years of the 7.5 years is when this takes place. "Abner the son of Ner went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. and they sat down, one on one side of the pool and one on the other side of the pool. You got to see this scene, you guys. This is a huge pool. It's still there. If you go to Israel, you can still see it. It's about 80 feet across. No, about 60 feet across and about 85 feet deep. It's a big, huge thing. And what happened was, Abner collects these guys through the years and gets himself a standing army that's big enough to come down and poke around and see how strong David is in the south. And Joab, who's an extremely dangerous man, Joab and Abishai and Asahel are David's nephews, all the sons of Zeruiah, David's sister. All dangerous men, all hot-headed, all could kill you in a twinkling of an eye with any weapon of choice of the day. They were very dangerous guys. And Joab is David's main commander. Joab knows that Abner's coming, so he gets David's guys together, and they go up, and they see each other. And these guys all know each other. How you doing, Abner? Fine, Joab. And everybody's kind of rattling the swords, and they're all standing there on either side of this pool. And they don't know what to do. They all know each other. They're all, but they know that this is a major power thing. I mean, if they let Abner get further south with this army, David might be in trouble. So Joab has gone up to stop him. And they all stop right there, and they all sit down and just look at each other across the pool. It's a great scene. It is a great scene. You can cut this atmosphere with a knife. And finally what happens is, as the story unfolds, verse 13, Joab the son of Zeruiah, the servants of David, went to meet him at the pool of Gibeon, sat down, one on one side, one on the other. Abner said to Joab, "Let's have the young men arise and hold a contest." They're not talking about a football game. What they're talking about is, you pick 12 of your best guys, I'll pick 12 of my best guys, and we'll see them fight to the death, and whoever wins, the other army will go away. Let's try that. Because they all know this cannot end until one of these two armies gives up, and they're just all just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. They arose and went over by count, 12 from Benjamin, and Ishbosheth, the sons of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. The warriors of Benjamin were renowned for being very, very deadly. Each of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into the opponent's side, and they fell together. Hilkat Hazarim is what it's called, the place of battle. The situation was that when they fought, all of them died, which is an odd thing. A complete standoff, all of them died. And so they figured, we better have a war after all. Verse 17, the day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And they were severely beaten. They lost over 300. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Anytime there was a war, anytime anybody could stand a chance of being killed, you could find these three guys. And if they weren't doing the killing, they were watching. These guys were really into the battle scene. And as it turns out, Asahel, who's the youngest and the fastest, thinks he can get the old lion, Abner, who's been around a long time. He's killed a lot of guys. But Asahel is also a young warrior. He's very dangerous. And he's thinking, I can get Abner. So he chases him. Asahel pursues Abner and didn't turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Abner looked behind him. Is that you, Asahel? He said, yeah, it's me. They all know each other. It's an amazing scene. And Abner knows Asahel intends to kill him. And Abner says, look, turn to your left or to your right. Take hold of what you go fight somebody else and take the spoil from him, Asahel. But Asahel wasn't willing to turn to the left or to the right. He thought, I can get this old codger. I know I can, and David will be very happy. And Abner repeated it again. Turn aside. Don't follow me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to Joab, your brother? You know, I'd never be able to talk to your brother again if I kill you. Get out of here, kid. Get out. I'm telling you. Get out of here. And he's running, and Asahel's catching up with him. He wasn't willing. He refused to turn aside. So Abner pulled an old trick. He struck him in the belly with the butt of his spear. He stopped so fast, and he just went boom like that and went all the way through him. Whether he intended to kill him or just knock the wind out of him, we don't know. But it went all the way through him, came out his back. And that's the dull end of the spear, folks. He fell there and died on the spot. It came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Both armies just saw Asahel. They knew who Asahel was. Asahel is the brother of Joab. This is not going to end here, I guarantee it. And he's the nephew of King David. It's a very, very serious deal. Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. They continued to chase Abner's army. When the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Amah, which is in front of Giah, by the way, in the wilderness of Gibeon. And the sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. Abner and the guys kept running. Joab and Abishai and their soldiers caught up. They saw the body of their brother, and they just were determined to catch Abner. So they continued to chase him until he got up on a hill. And old Abner, he gets up to the top of the hill. And much to his great relief, there's a whole squad of Benjamites up there. And they surround him, and they have a very easily defended place. Plus, everybody's exhausted after fighting all day. And so Abner gives him a chance. Abner says, "Do you want to keep doing this? Do you want to keep doing this?" And Joab says, "Okay, we won't. We'll stop here." But Joab does not forget. Abner called down to Joab, verse 26, and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end if we keep doing this? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? We need to stop this." And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, we would have followed you until morning." And we would have all followed our brothers, verse 27. So Joab blew the trumpet. All the people halted, pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. Abner and his men went through the Arabah all that night, a forced march across the Jordan River to safety. So they crossed the Jordan, walked all the morning, and came to Mahanaim. And Joab returned from following Abner, and he gathered all the people together, and only 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died total. So, and most of those were Abishai's, Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night until day dawned at Hebron. And so David heard about this afterward. This is a major, major turning point. This war went on for 7.5 years, not a constant pitched battle, but this type of thing happened. Chapter 3 describes more of it. David had 6 wives, and of those wives, each one bore him a son. And the reason the narrator tells us this is because what we want to see here is David's clan growing, Saul's strength fading. God had cursed the household of Saul, and he had blessed David. And that's what the narrator is telling us. It was a long war, it says in chapter 3, verse 1. In the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but Saul's house grew weaker. Sons were born to David at Hebron. Most of the famous sons of David were all born in Hebron during this 7.5-year period, or the last 2 years, actually. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. Second was Kileab. We'll hear about all these guys later. By Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. The third was Absalom by Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. That's a political marriage, by the way. The fourth was Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth was Shephatiah, the son of Abital. We don't know very much about these wives. And the sixth was Ithream, and that was by David's wife Eglah. Not a favorite name for girls today. These were born to David at Hebron. Funny how some names catch on and some do not. We'll see a lot more about all of these folks later, but the point we need to see here is that his house is growing. It came about that while there was a war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now, I want you to bear in mind, Abner's a strength up there. Abner is the guy who really calls the shots, and it's getting more and more that way. Saul had a concubine, verse 7, whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Abner was very angry over these words. He says, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah. I suppose that's a really angry thing to say. I've never said that to anybody, but I'm guessing that this is a mean thing to say. Am I a dog's head? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers, and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. In other words, you'd be dead right now, and everybody would be working for David if it weren't for me. And you accuse me of taking Saul's concubine. He says, well, that's it. I'm giving everybody to David. I'm turning it over. And it's a very important turning point, the end of this 7.5 years, when Abner decides, not Ishbosheth, but Abner decides he's going to turn this thing around and bring the people to David's side. Verse 9, may God do so to Abner and more also, if as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul, to establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ishbosheth could no longer answer Abner because he was afraid of him. Of course, Ishbosheth's a weakling. He wasn't really the king. He had no anointing from God. And the real power behind the throne up there was Abner. Did Abner really do this thing? It would have been political. It's not about lust, I guarantee you. It's about politics. If he did it, what he was saying was, I deserve to have Saul's harem. And what that means is, if you have a king's harem, you have his prestige, you have his throne. I deserve to have Saul's harem. I deserve to be in charge. Did Abner do it? We don't know. We don't know. Ishbosheth believed he did. The whole thing was doomed from the beginning, and so it falls apart. We really don't know all the details. We do know that Abner was pretty power hungry and that he was in charge up there, so whatever. At this point, Abner turns around. He sends a messenger to David, verse 12. He said, make your covenant with me. My hand shall be with you to bring all Israel over to you. Imagine David getting this. And he looks around at his guys. Now, Joab was missing from this powwow. But here's David. He gets this message, and somebody says, this has the seal of Abner on it, and he's saying he's bringing all Israel over to us. Oh, my. That would have brought a big smile to David. But there was one piece of unfinished business. His first wife, Michal. He'd been married to Saul's daughter, Michal. And Saul took her away from him, but they were never divorced. So she was still legally married to David, even though Saul gave her to a guy named Paltiel. And Paltiel apparently loved her greatly. And she probably loved him. We're not sure, but she was embittered against David. So it's, chances are that in that somewhat illegal marriage that she had, sort of marriage, not marriage, to Paltiel, she had fallen in love with this man. And we know that he loved her because of what happens here. But David wants her back. You say, well, that's kind of mean, isn't it? That's the deal David makes. He says, I'll make a deal with you. Verse 13, he says, good, I'm glad you want to come over. I'll make a covenant with you. I demand one thing. I only need one thing. You got to get, before you see my face, I want to see Michal, Saul's daughter. Then you bring her to me. You send her to me. David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and said, give me my wife, Michal, to whom I was betrothed for 400 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband. He calls him a husband, but there's a real question of whether they were legally married because David had never let her go. From Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband, this is a real tearjerker, verse 16. Her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her as far as Bahurim. And Abner said, go home. And he had to leave. Abner would have killed him because this deal had to happen. He said, you have to leave. That's it. It's a poignant thing. And I feel sorry for Michal in a lot of ways. She was caught in the political thing. And yet I wonder if she hadn't said, I'm still married to David and I'm not marrying anybody else. If it would have been different. You know, there's a lot of pain involved in broken human relationships. And there's no way to make that not happen. There's no way to make that not happen. But we can save some grief by hanging on to what God says and by doing things God's way. I don't know how much choice Michal had in all of this because women had many fewer rights in those days. In this culture, but she had influence with her father. They had a lot of influence. I wonder if she'd have said, I'm waiting for David. I don't care what anybody says. if this scene might never have happened. But at any rate, it does happen. And David takes her back, not so much because he remembers his great love for her, but because to be married to Saul's daughter is extremely important for the solidity of the kingdom. This is something of a political thing. And for him to let his wife go to another man was a terrible thing. I mean, everybody would have said, well, you know, Michal still belongs to Paltiel. And David never took her back. And so David had to, for political reasons and for personal reasons, he felt he needed to have her back in his household. Abner had a consultation with the elders of Israel. Now notice what he says. He brings her back. Then he goes to the leaders of Israel, the north, and he says, you've always wanted David to be king over you. Isn't that interesting? The word was out. He says, now's the time. Do it. The Lord has spoken of David and has said, by the hand of my servant David, I'll save my people from Israel, from the hand of the Philistines, and from the hand of their enemies. And this is what Abner also said in the hearing of Benjamin, verse 19. And in addition, Abner went to speak in the hearing of David at Hebron, and it all seemed good to Israel and to the whole house of Benjamin. Very interesting. I have a question for Abner. Abner, how long have you known that God really intended for David to be the king, and why did it take you 7.5 years to come around to this? Isn't that interesting? Because he quotes right here, he says, we all know, and we all know that you want David to be king. So Abner, Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Political Helper to David, how come it's taken you so long to do what you knew all along was God's will? It's an interesting thing about Abner and Joab. Abner comes down there with 20 bodyguards, make a deal with David, and David said, I'm really happy, sends Abner back, and David walks back from that meeting, that summit meeting in verse 21. This is great. Well, Joab wasn't there. Joab, whose brother Abner had killed. Joab shows up to David, and he lights into him. He's incensed. He's livid that David let Abner get away from him. Joab would have killed Abner the minute he saw him. And he says, David, you know this guy's lying to you. He's going to find out all about you, and he's going to try and kill you. And we're not sure that that's true. But we are sure that Joab had other things on his mind. Verses 26 to 30, Joab tracks him down. He's only a couple of miles away. Joab had come back from a raid, takes his guys, without telling David. He takes off, and he tracks down Abner, and he says, Abner, come on over here. I got to talk to you. And Abner comes over there quietly to talk to Joab. They all know each other, and Abner's not afraid of him, and Joab killed him, bing, just like that. When David hears about it, he, in turn, is completely incensed, and he immediately distances himself from Abner. Verse 28, afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord over the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and all his household, and there may there not fail. He curses. You don't see this very often. David curses Joab's family. This is his nephew, but he curses him. May there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge. I want everybody bleeding in that guy's house. Or one who's a leper. I want always there to be a leper in that guy's house. Or one who takes hold of a distaff. One who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. Terrible, terrible curse against Joab. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner. They worked it out together and killed Abner, murdered him, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the Battle of Gibeon. Ah. There's also another thing to take in consideration. Who is Abner? He's a general. Who is Joab? He's a general. When Abner comes over with a whole army from northern Israel, who's going to get a piece of Joab's pie? A big piece, probably, in exchange for his loyalty to David. And Joab has no intention of sharing anything with anybody, if you ever know anything about Joab. Well, anyway, David then does another very politically shrewd thing. He distances himself from Joab, even though he's family. He makes everybody tear their clothes, verses 31 and following. Writes a shorter song for Abner, verses 33 and 34. and vows that this was not his will. Now, this is very important because he wants the rest of northern Israel to know he wasn't behind this assassination. And he makes it very, very, very clear. He also makes it very clear down through verse 39, he says, I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his deed. He says, I can't handle these guys. Now, question, why didn't David have Joab arrested and executed? Nobody knows. But you can guess. Family. He's family, plus also so many of the soldiers are absolutely loyal to him. Joab was a fearless warrior and very fiercely loyal to David. And David just didn't do it. But you know what he did do? You know the story? He curses him. He says he deserves to be executed. And on his deathbed, he told his son Solomon, execute Joab. And that's one of the first things Solomon did in 1 Kings, was he executed Joab. Because Joab doesn't stop here. He does this again with another man named Amasa. We'll read about it later. Joab is absolutely ruthless. So David doesn't deal with him here. He lets Joab continue to be his general all through David's life. In fact, Joab outlived David, but not by much. And I think maybe he was just waiting for God to judge him, and since it didn't happen in his lifetime, the last thing David said was, kill Joab! Okay? So it doesn't end here. Chapter 4, once they find out that Abner's dead, he's the real power up there, two rather creepazoid guys by the name of Rechab and Baanah thought, hey, I know what we'll do. We'll kill the king of Israel, and we'll take his head down to David. And David will reward us. They should have read the story. Huh? Well, that's what they do. They killed Ish-bosheth on his bed. They snuck into his house, and while he was asleep, they killed him, beheaded him, took his head down to David. And David said, thank you very much, and had them executed immediately because he would not abide assassination. He just would not have it. You could not assassinate a king of Israel, even if it was David's mortal enemy. He wouldn't allow it. And he had those guys killed. And everybody learned a big lesson. They all looked around at each other and they said, I guess we shouldn't kill the king of Israel. And that's exactly what David intended the whole time. I know I went kind of fast through chapter 4, but our time's run out. And I wanted to share, as we close, I want to finish up a couple things here. Would you notice what a weird world they lived in? Look at the assassinations and the stuff going on behind the scenes. When they, wow, this is in the Bible. I thought in the Bible, you know, God was always at work and things were always working out the way he wanted and so on and so forth. Well, he is. He is at work. But he uses evil. What else would he work with? Let me ask you, if he couldn't use evil on the earth. And he does. So let's note some things. Note, first of all, how many important issues were out of David's control. And yet, the Lord's will was done in David's life. Look at how many important things were out of his control. Joab's actions, Abner's actions, almost everybody that had a real impact on David, David could not control. And yet, because David belonged to the Lord, God's will was accomplished in David's life, even if he had to use evil to do it. And he had to. He did use evil to do it. The kingdom came to David. David did not raise his hand against any Israelis. He did not raise his hand against the king of Israel. He waited, and God brought it to him. Now, later, David becomes very directive. But that's a different part of the story. At this point, David simply says, Lord, I'm not going to violate your word. I will wait. He waited another 7.5 years after his 30th birthday. And finally, the Lord brought the whole thing over. Patience and faith. But do not disobey God. Just trust him. How many things are out of our control about life? And we say, well, is God's will going to be done? Yes. My will might not be done, especially not fast enough. But God's will be done if I wait on him and belong to him. How many important issues are out of David's control? Serving the Lord in a confusing time isn't really that complex. All you got to do is what you got to do. And that's really a relatively small thing. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to change everybody else. All you got to do is what you got to do and trust God. Notice this as well. How many evil deeds occurred, and yet the Lord's plan was fulfilled. When you look at how evil the world is, do not lose heart. When you see evil happening, do not lose heart. God knows what he's doing. He knows the soul of every single human being. And if you think you see a miscarriage of justice, then maybe you are seeing a miscarriage of justice on a human level. But the fact of the matter is, God knows what he's doing. Even if we have to resist injustice, and we do, we have to trust that God knows at all times. The amount of evil that takes place, not just here, but as the years go by, we'll read the rest of these stories. It's an amazing thing. And yet all through it, God says, "No, I know what I'm doing. I'm using the evil these people do, and everything will come back on their own heads. If you don't want to be a part of the evil, you serve me in the middle of this. You just do what I tell you to do in the middle of this and let me handle these other details." It's an amazing way to live. And I want you to notice too, and I'll close with this, how to be a bad leader in the family of God. There's a real contrast between Abner and Joab and David. All of them were leaders. All of them were warriors. All of them were renowned. All of them the people knew. But David is the one that serves God. The way to be a bad leader is to have your own agenda instead of God's. And that's not just for leaders. That's for everybody. The way to fail in a fallen world is to say, you know what? I'm despairing of God getting anything done. I'm doing what I'm taking it into my own hands. That's why Abner waited 7.5 years. He wanted to see if he could have some power up there. And it backfired on him. That's why Joab killed Abner, because he had his own agenda too. And that's why Joab was finally executed. The contrast is obvious. We live in a fallen world. It's a very dangerous place. There's a lot of evil. God says, don't you be part of it. Don't you worry about whether I can use it, but don't you be a part of it. Instead, you serve me in your generation and in your home or wherever you are. You live by what I've given you, and I will bless you in the midst of this evil. It's an amazing, amazing thing. Watch how David gets all that God has for him, and David himself never has to really, quote unquote, struggle to get it. Now, there are struggles in David's life, but you know what I'm talking about. We look at our fallen world. The answer is the same in the 21st century as it was 1,000 years before Christ. There are only two ways to live. One is in faith, and the other is in the flesh. Let's bow our heads. Father God, only you understand what's going on in our souls and our hearts at any given moment. I lift up anybody who came in here tonight wondering whether or not you could use the messed up stuff that goes on around our lives sometimes, even our own grievous errors and sins. And I pray, Father, that your Holy Spirit would speak directly to these circumstances, whatever they may be. I'm not aware of them, but I know you are, Lord. And I pray that there would be a sense of peace about this. But that you would also show, as David turned to you for guidance, so we do too. Show every person, Father, who came here tonight wondering, fearful, overly concerned about details outside their control. Show them how to respond, maybe not to solve it all, maybe not to understand every detail, but how to respond in faith, as you showed David. We rejoice, Lord, that your wisdom is greater than our weakness, than our ignorance, and than the sin, much greater than the sin that this world serves up. Thank you for reminding us of these things in communion this evening, in worship, and in your word. In Jesus' name, amen.